Your name?
Michael Wilson.
What brings you to the Northwest One Library this morning?
Well, we were supposed to be attending a meeting this morning with the advisory neighborhood commissioners from 6C and Walmart and JBG, who is a developer of a proposed Walmart site at 801 New Jersey Avenue Northwest.
It's not a lot of... I've seen some activists, some Respect DC folks, including yourself, but no one from Walmart, no one from JBG.
Yeah, unfortunately, we found out yesterday afternoon with less than 24 hours notice that the meeting had been canceled. Once Walmart and JBG found out that we had invited community members and residents to attend what they had wanted to be a closed meeting, it was canceled by the Advisory Neighborhood Commission 6C, Walmart and JBG. This area, unfortunately, there has been very few opportunities for community input or dialogue around the project. This is despite the fact that they've already started doing some construction work on the site. There's only been one community meeting here that was open to the public, and it was over a year ago that JBG and Walmart attended. So we felt it was very important for folks from the community, residents from this area, to be able to come and ask questions and hear from Walmart and JBG, even just the basics about what they're planning to do, but also to have a process for them to have some input into what the development was going to look like. And it seems that Walmart and JBG really don't want that to happen, seeing as that they were willing to cancel this meeting with less than 24 hours notice, just because some residents and community members were planning to attend.
And you are going to be on the panel amongst the panelists?
Yeah, initially the panel was intended to be all the advisory neighborhood commissioners from 6C, representatives from Walmart and JBG, the developer. And then the advisory neighborhood commission has some study groups around traffic and transportation and education and youth and things like that. So those folks were going to be on it. And then one of the advisory neighborhood commissioners who represents the single member district where Walmart is proposing to build the store, Keith Silver, had formed an impact study group that was supposed to be looking at the impact to the area of the Walmart. And so the folks on that study group were also invited to attend. I was sort of a replacement for one of those people who couldn't attend. Once they saw, the advisory neighborhood commissioners saw that that Respect DC was inviting people to attend the meeting, they disinvited me from attending prior to canceling the meeting. But I was planning on attending anyways with the folks from the residents from the neighborhood and community members and other folks from Respect DC, because, like I said, there's very few opportunities that Walmart and these developers have given for there to be real public scrutiny of what they're doing. Unfortunately, our elected officials haven't forced them to have open meetings. And we need to take the opportunities where they are to be able to come out and show community members and residents what Walmart and these developers are really about. And, it's pretty clear when you're hiding from that, when you're canceling meetings to avoid even answering simple questions. I don't think that I hope that Walmart and JBG didn't think we were going to be showing up here with, pitchforks and torches today. The idea was just to be able to ask folks questions and hear what Walmart and JBG had to say. And, hiding from that seems a little bit, it shows what's going on, I think.
What were some of the points you had hoped to raise to Walmart and JBG?
Well, for JBG specifically, the project that they're planning on building here is mixed use. It's one of the places where they're actually both projects JBG is doing proposed to do with Walmart, both here and by the Fort Totten Metro, are mixed use. And so they include housing above the Walmart retail. And, I've heard, because they have held a couple public meetings around the Fort Totten site, that up there they're talking about one-bedroom apartments going for $1,800 a month. And we really wanted to know what they were planning on doing here, if it was a similar, cost that they were going to, similar price that they were planning to charge for the apartments in the building. Because, for a lot of people who live in this neighborhood, that's not going to be affordable. And especially, I don't think anybody who's working at Walmart is going to be able to live in apartments like that. So we also wanted to see if they were planning to do any sort of affordable housing set-asides and what formulas they were going to use to do that, to determine what affordable housing meant. For Walmart, we're still want to know if they will sit down with the community, if they will agree to put in writing some of the promises they're making around job creation and wages, specifically around this number of 300 jobs per store, if they're willing to say in writing, and make it enforceable that they will hire and maintain 300 employees on a schedule, you know, we really are skeptical about that. We do a lot of work with an organization, United for Respect at Walmart, which is a group of associates, current associates at Walmart, who are organizing to try and change the company. And one of their big issues is understaffing. And, you know, we've heard from associates from California who, you know, bigger stores, but, you know, so more jobs promised, but, you know, a store that opened with 650 employees, it's now down to 257 on the schedule. The Walmart store just here in Laurel, Maryland, which is, you know, twice the size of the stores they're talking about building here, has about that, about 250 people regularly on the schedule. And so it's a little bit hard to believe that they're going to maintain 300 people on a schedule at a store that's half the size. You know, and they might need it. I mean, these stores are likely to be high traffic given the areas where they're planning to build them, but that's why they should maintain 300 employees and, you know, keep their promises that they're making at these meetings, but they seem unwilling to sign anything that would hold them accountable. So
it's kind of surprising that there's only been one community meeting, because this is a major deal. This is a game changer for this community, and what you've already started, some work is already starting being done on the site, and yet we had just one community meeting. When you look at New York, they've done multiple major studies, and they're not even allowing Walmart to come in, but here in D.C., it's just a community meeting so far that's been had for this particular site.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's I think, unfortunately, a lot of the difference has to do with the way elected officials have responded to it. In New York, a lot of city council members have come out saying, you know, we need to look more closely at these deals, or, you know, just straight out, we don't need Walmart in New York. Unfortunately, here in D.C., there's been very few council members willing to stand up to them. And I think that has to do with a lot of things. I think it has to do with the way developers in the city are able to give money through the bundling of campaign contributions by starting these sort of fake LLCs whose sole purpose is to give maximum contributions to political candidates. Also, I mean, at this site specifically and some of the other ones, I mean, Walmart has hired one of the most powerful lobbyists in D.C., David Wilmot, to do a lot of the work for them at the city council. And he also has a financial stake in this particular site. Through the Bennett Group, which is the owners of the land, is kind of a long, drawn-out story of how they came to have it, involving, you know, the land was initially given by the Berry administration to developers to develop. Sharon Pratt Kelly tried to take it back. They sued. They won a lawsuit. So, I mean, it's technically city-owned land that's leased through a settlement judgment to the Bennett Group. But, you know, so he has a financial stake in it. He's getting paid by Walmart to lobby on their behalf. And he's also throwing fundraisers for a lot of political candidates, including Muriel Bowser, who there has two stores proposed in her ward, Ward 4, and Yvette Alexander, who also has two proposed in Ward 7. You know, he functioned as her attorney before the Board of Elections and Ethics, and, you know, was the campaign finance chair for Bowser. So it's pretty clear that, you know, there are things going on here that are making our politicians, our elected officials, sort of sit in the background and not hold Walmart or these developers' feet to the fire.
Mayor Gray, it was initially proposed that four stores come to D.C. It seemed that he was a proponent for pushing. Now we have six stores coming.
Yeah, I mean, it's just unfortunate the way that that elected officials have turned into either silent or loud cheerleaders for Walmart. And, you know, I think that in our conversations that we've had with Mayor Gray, unfortunately, he can't see past the thought of like a ribbon cutting ceremony of, hey, I can say that I brought this development. I can say that I brought these jobs. And, you know, there's just no real willingness to look at the track record of this company, you know, and that's part of the reason that, you know, the Respect DC campaign has been pushing this for a community benefits agreement, is that we don't feel like that DC should trust Walmart's track record to build the future of the city. And, you know, you look at the idea of having six stores, like that's, you know, like you said, it's a game changer for this neighborhood for one, but six in the city is going to be a huge change for DC. And if you look at Walmart's track record, you know, when they opened in Chicago, it was in nationwide, it's 1.4 jobs lost for every job gained at Walmart. You know, 40% of businesses within a mile of the first store that opened in Chicago were closed within 2 years. You know, these are not things that lead to economic development. These are not things that lead to job growth. These are things that lead to jobs leaving, to other businesses closing and leaving. And, you know, for some reason, when you talk to Mayor Gray, when you talk to Deputy Mayor Victor Hoskins, they'll tell you that they just don't think that those results are going to happen here. They don't really have an explanation for why they think DC is unlike every other jurisdiction in the country where Walmart is open. They just don't seem to want to believe it. And I think it's a lot because, you know, they're sort of blinded by, hey, we can say we did this. We can say short term that we brought these developments. But long term for the city, it doesn't seem like, based on Walmart's track record, it's going to bring good things.
I actually asked Mayor Gray if he had read, which I'm going to read a bit from, this 2010 report by Hunter College and the New York City Public Advocate. And it was interesting, the day that I asked him that was the announcement of $3 million for job training that Walmart is bringing in, which is another issue we need to touch on. Walmart has really spread an awful lot of money around to nonprofits and others here. But this Walmart's economic footprint is a 2010 report prepared by Hunter College, Community Planning and Development, and New York City Public Advocate Bill de Blasio. And the study looked at Chicago, the first city to have Walmart come in, and it concluded, quote, Walmart is trying to take advantage of the current economic downturn by promising an immediate infusion of jobs and investment dollars in city neighborhoods that have been hit hard by the recession. Considering the body of independent research that clearly demonstrates Walmart's negative long-term impacts on local economies, it would be short-sighted to allow this destructive monopolist to enter the New York City market via the Trojan horse of job creation, end quote. This is a striking statement, a serious report coming out of New York, and yet you're saying that D.C.'s leaders, I mean, I asked Mayor Gray, he hadn't even read this. We haven't put together any reports here in D.C. of the like.
Right, no, I don't know, you know, what studies Mayor Gray has read. It seems like by the way that he is acting and dealing with the situation that he hasn't looked at any of them. And, you know, we also asked Victor Hoskins, the Deputy Mayor for Planning and Economic Development, who also said that they had just hadn't done the research. And it's concerning, to say the least, that our elected officials who are bringing these stores into D.C. Aren't even willing to do the basic amount of research on what it's going to mean long term for the city. I mean, we even asked Hoskins if he had looked at some of the stores in the surrounding area and what they had done to the communities in the surrounding area to get an even closer look at what Walmart might do to D.C. And they hadn't even bothered to do that. They hadn't been to visit any of these other stores. We're actually, Respect D.C. is planning soon to take a group of residents and community leaders from D.C. to visit the Capitol Plaza store in Landover Hills, Maryland, to get a sense of what Walmart looks like, one of the closest ones to the city. And, you know, I don't know if you or other folks have been to that store, but it was similarly, you know, it opened in, I think, 2005 or 2006, so not that long ago. Walmart came into that community promising that they were going to be this growth leader, that it was going to spark development on that corridor around 450 and the BW Parkway. If you go out there now, Capitol Plaza, where it is just that Walmart. The main, you know, marquee sign out front says Walmart and has a for lease sign. Otherwise, in the parking lot, there's a McDonald's and some abandoned other stores. The Safeway that was immediately next door to that closed, losing all of those union jobs from the neighborhood. And, you know, if you talk to folks who live around there, a lot of them are really unhappy with the quality of service, the level of staffing, the level of stocking. I've been in that store before, like, you know, empty shelves. I've talked to some of the people who work there, and, you know, it's, again, you know, when they came in, they were promising wages, competitive wages like they are here, you know, and apparently what that means is around $9 an hour, which, you know, is competitive with a retail market that Walmart has created by driving wages down across the country. But, you know, people can't live on that around here. We've talked to folks who live in D.C. who have worked in that store, who had to stop working there because it wasn't even worth it, the amount of money they were spending to transport themselves from D.C. to Capitol Plaza and get their kids in daycare, ate up their entire paycheck or more. Many of them were still on TANF and food stamps and healthcare alliance while they were working there. And this is the kind of jobs that we're trying to bring to D.C. It just doesn't really seem to make sense.
Can you talk about, it's really unprecedented, not just six stores in D.C., but how many stores are Walmart looking to bring to this immediate area?
I think, like, in the whole, you know, depending on how broad, at something like 40 they're looking at. In the, they proposed some in Montgomery County, they proposed some in Southern Maryland, they proposed some in Virginia around Tyson's Corner, Oxon Hill, Rockville Pike. I mean, like, they're looking to expand everywhere.
Returning again to this report from the New York City Public Advocate and Hunter College, Walmart's formula for financial success includes low wage or limited health benefits and leveraging of government benefits. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, Walmart has been very good at getting government subsidies to open their stores in different places. One thing that they've said repeatedly in D.C. is we're not asking for subsidies. But, I mean, you look at some of the infrastructure work that's already been going on around these stores that's being done by DDOT. And, you know, we've asked them before, we've asked DDOT and other folks, you know, who's paying for these things. And they'll say, you know, well, the developer's responsible, or, you know, they'll tell us who's responsible for doing it, but, like, who's actually paying for it? Still kind of unclear. And, you know, the longer term infrastructure improvements that might be needed based on the additional traffic that these stores are going to bring to areas, you know, it's very unclear who's going to be end up being responsible for that. It's also, you know, as the study sort of alludes to, there's a lot of government benefits that go to Walmart employees because they're getting paid so little. As I was saying, like, about folks who worked at the Capitol Plaza store and lived in D.C., it's like, if you're not making enough money, you're still on a lot of government assistance programs. It's basically the government subsidizing the poor wages and the poor benefits that Walmart offers.
I want to return back to the amount of money that Walmart has spread around this area, $3 million for job training, and that announcement they did with Mayor Gray, where I asked him whether he'd read the report by the New York City Public Advocate. He had not. They have just funded a report. IFF has done a study on schools saying we should close more neighborhood schools and build more charter schools. The Walton Foundation has been an extreme proponent of charter schools and gave $25 million to the recent teachers contract, which helped to eviscerate tenure and also try to enshrine Michelle Rhee in her position. And then in a recent article, the Post noted that Walmart's charitable foundation provided grants and donations to D.C. nonprofit organizations in recent years, including more than $2 million in fiscal 2010. We're now in 2012. I imagine that has continued on par. But talk about the money that they've spread around here.
Well, it's really, I mean, it is quite something. I mean, Walmart is the largest, richest corporation in the world. They had $400 billion in revenue in 2010, 2011, $15 billion in profits. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting the money that they're putting in here, because it is a lot of money. I mean, it is, that, you know, to the organizations who are receiving it, but to Walmart, it's really not. I mean, you look at, you know, $3 million, $2 million in the context of a company that makes $15 billion a year, and it becomes sort of a drop in the bucket for them, but a big deal for the organizations who are receiving it. I also think that, you know, part of what they're trying to do is say, like, you know, through some of the charitable stuff, it's like, okay, we're gonna sort of grease the wheels for us to get in here. You know, if we give this organization something, maybe they won't, you know, say anything negative about us. Maybe they won't oppose our entry. And, you know, with the job training money too, it's like, oh, look, we care. We're trying to help out. But, you know, you look at where that job training money has gone or is going, and, you know, there's no guarantee that anyone who complete those programs are going to be offered jobs at Walmart or going to get jobs at Walmart or anywhere else for that matter. And, you know, and then you look at where they're really funneling the majority of the money, and it is to these things like the teacher's contract or this IFF study, the purpose of which is to close traditional public schools and open charters. I mean, the conclusions of that IFF study were, here's a list of, I don't even remember how many it was, a couple dozen schools, mostly in Ward 7 and 8, that should be converted to charters. And, you know, I mean, I think that everyone who is, you know, paid attention to the education reform movement here in D.C. knows, you know, sometimes charters are better, sometimes they're not. And especially in cases where there's failing schools that have been taken over by charters, the results have not been markedly different than when they were traditional public schools. The difference is in the way that charter schools treat their employees, in the way that charter schools are allowed to be more discriminatory about who they allow into the school. And, you know, I mean, the real thing that seems to be going on is, you know, the Walton Foundation and Walmart really like charter schools because they undermine teachers' unions. And that's really, I think, a lot of what that push is about. And, you know, I think that people in D.C. and even our elected officials really need to think about what it's going to mean to allow the, you know, heavy influence of Walmart money to one, be dictating things that happen within our school system, but two, just to be more generally having an influence on public policy in the city. I mean, this is a pretty, you know, likes to present itself as a pretty progressive left of center place. Those aren't the values of the Walton family. Those aren't the values of Walmart. I mean, this is a company that gives much more money to Republican candidates, including many who oppose DC voting rights and statehood. And, you know, it's like, what is that going to mean locally if they start to decide we want to get involved, you know, beyond even just, you know, closing traditional public schools and opening charters, but in other issues in D.C., you know, they have the money to really change the way politics works here.
In addition to the jobs mantle being one of the big reasons that Walmart justifications used for Walmart being needed to come in is the doing away with food deserts, right, large areas that don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. A recent report, again coming out of New York, by the Office of Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer, entitled Food for Thought, A Case Study of Walmart's Impact on Harlem's Health Food Retail Landscape, concludes that Walmart's entrance into the New York City market could severely undermine, if not reverse, the progress made by existing fresh food initiatives. So they're finding that just the opposite takes place. Instead of more access to fresh fruits and vegetables, you see less. How does that play out?
Well, it has to do, again, with how many stores, how many local competing businesses Walmart ends up shutting down. So it's like, if you have a neighborhood that has, you know, a few corner stores, you know, I mean, you look at the neighborhoods even here in D.C. where Walmart is looking to build. So this location at 801 New Jersey Avenue, there is a brand new Safeway at 5th and L in Northwest, so, you know, just blocks away. There's a brand new Harris Teeter on 1st Street Northwest, also blocks away. They're building a brand new Giant at 3rd and H Northeast, you know, again, a few blocks away from where they're proposing to build a store. You know, you'd be hard-pressed to call a place where there's, you know, already two, soon to be three existing grocery stores within blocks to be a food desert. And, you know, all of these proposed locations have a Safeway or Giant within a mile of them. And, you know, I think that Walmart has been trying to sort of take advantage of this this idea that they can be a solution to what is a real problem, which is this food desert, this lack of access to fresh fruits and vegetables in many areas, you know, and it does happen in D.C. But, you know, not only that report, there was a recent report that came out by Food and Water Watch. There was a recent series that was done by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance that talked about this very thing that the Manhattan Borough president points out, which is that, you know, in the end, if you have a store open like Walmart, in the short term, it may provide one more place that is offering fruits and vegetables. But in the end, everything that had been offering those things in the immediate vicinity closes. And then, you know, you, instead of having a ton of different options where you can get those things, you have one place, which is Walmart. And, you know, as folks have seen in other communities, the quality, the variety, all the prices, all those things change once the competition is gone around a Walmart. And, you know, that's their model. They drive out other businesses, and then they sort of consolidate into what they need to do to maintain being the only store, the only option. And, you know, that unless we force them to change, that's the model that they're likely to use here in D.C. as well.
You mentioned the Food and Water Watch report. I wanted to read a bit from it, why Walmart can't fix the food system. They write, Walmart's the biggest company in the United States with 2010 sales of $419 billion, a little over half of that coming from grocery sales. In the past 12 years, it began selling food alongside other retail products. Walmart has become the largest food retailer in the U.S. One out of $3 spent on groceries in the U.S. goes to Walmart. Food isn't just good business for Walmart. It's the cornerstone of the company's public relations offensive. The Food and Water Watch report analyzes Walmart's ambitious campaign to convince skeptical local governments and communities that the company can alleviate the problem of food deserts. But the report finds that this is merely window dressing to divert attention away from the company's business model, which squeezes farmers, workers, and processors, and drives food production to become more consolidated and industrialized. Continuing, Walmart is so big that it has an unprecedented amount of power in all sectors of the economy. Food is no exception. When there is one player this large, consumers are no longer the food industry's customers. Walmart is. And the saying, the customer is always right, has never been more appropriate. Walmart is such a large customer that even large food processors cannot refuse any demands that Walmart makes upon them. The company's model is based on practices that drive consolidation, take money away from farmers, workers, and processors, and drive agriculture to get more industrialized. Walmart's business model is part of the problem, which means the company is not going to be a meaningful part of the solution to problems in the food supply. Instead of succumbing to Walmart's public relations offensive and pressure to be allowed in new urban areas, all levels of government should look for other solutions to increase communities' access to healthy food. That, again, from Food and Water Watch, from the executive summary.
Yeah, no, I mean, and like I said, you know, there are, these studies are out there. I mean, they're out there. They're available for Mayor Gray, for our council members, for Victor Hoskins, for everyone to look at and read. And, you know, I think that every time one of these studies comes out, you know, Walmart will say, oh, you know, they'll have some excuse for why this isn't true. But it's like every single time one of these studies comes out, it paints the real picture of what Walmart has done and what Walmart is planning to continue to do to local communities, to workers, and as this report points out, to the food system. I mean, I think that there's been well-documented stories in the past of how Walmart has tried to drive down their price point for other goods, you know, in their retail stuff, and you know, how that's driven many manufacturing jobs to leave the United States and go overseas to be competitive, how that's led to lower quality products being sold in their stores. And, you know, it's like, is that what we want for the food industry? Is that what we want? You know, is that what we want? Do we want to be buying our food in a way that has been influenced by Walmart, so things are just being done the cheapest way possible? And, you know, what does that mean for the people who produce the food? You know, what does that mean for the entire supply chain? And what does that mean for the end product that you're getting at the grocery store? I think that, you know, that's really what Food and Water Watch was trying to point out. And also, as we were talking about earlier, the fact that really the reality is Walmart does not solve this problem. Walmart is a contributor to this problem of food deserts in our neighborhoods and communities. And it really doesn't make any sense to say, hey, the way we're going to solve this problem of a lack of access to affordable fruits and vegetables is to bring in a company that's going to, as its track record has shown, drive out everyone else who sells these things and, you know, leave us with only one option.
And it's not just Walmart's effect on its supply when it comes to food, but this is the same model that it, in other areas. The 2010 report from the New York City Public Advocate says, quote, 85% of Walmart's items are made overseas. The mega retailer has faced numerous accusations of unacceptable conditions in the factories of their suppliers. Reported abuses include forced overtime, locked bathrooms, starvation wages, pregnancy tests, denial of access to health care, and workers fired and blacklisted if they try to defend their rights, end quote. Can you talk about Walmart's impact, not just here, but abroad?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge issue. I mean, you look at, like I said, the jobs that have left the United States to go overseas to manufacture products for Walmart. You know, we did, in last April, we brought folks to DC who are from both, it was sort of like the whole Walmart supply chain. So it was a woman who worked at a Walmart store actually in Laurel, a man who worked at a Walmart warehouse outside, I think, Chicago, and then two women who worked at a factory that produced apparel for Walmart in Bangladesh. And, you know, to hear their stories, it's like it just shows how devastating Walmart is across the board. You know, the folks from Bangladesh, you know, had really horrible stories about the hours that they were forced to work, forced overtime, the really just horrible wages that they were paid, the abuse that they took from their managers. And, you know, Walmart likes to, like many other companies, present this sort of, oh, we don't control those factories. But they're only producing for Walmart, you know, and you know, having this one level of disconnect doesn't make Walmart any less responsible for what's going on there. And, you know, their whole model is to drive things, to drive prices as low as possible. But what that means is driving wages as low as possible, driving working conditions as low as possible. And like I said, it's not just in their stores, but it happens in their warehouses and it happens in their factories.
Can you talk about the scale of this company? I was shocked to read that one out of $3 spent on groceries goes to Walmart. And I was reading Barbara Ehrenreich's piece, recent piece, Walmart, It's Alive. She writes, what is Walmart in a strictly taxonomic sense, that is? Based on size alone, it would be easy to confuse it with a nation. In 2002, its annual revenue was equal to or exceeded that of all but 22 nation states. Or if all its employees, 1.4 million in the U.S. alone, were to gather in one place, you might think you were looking at a major city.
Yeah, I mean, just the 1.4 million employees is kind of is a shocking number, and that's just here in the United States. You know, they're the biggest employer behind the in the world behind the Department of Defense and the Chinese Army, and you know, like I said, $15 billion in profits, $400 billion in revenue, and then you look at the people at the very top of the company, the owners. I mean, the Walton family, which is the sort of heirs to the fortune that Sam Walton, the founder, left. Are six of the richest people in the world. They control more wealth than the bottom 30% of Americans combined. They're worth billions of dollars each. And, you know, they make just off dividends, hundreds of millions of dollars a year off of this company, yet they refuse to pay their workers. You know, the average wage is $8.81 an hour. You know, there's been studies done that show just to pay $12 an hour to their employees, if they passed the entire cost of that pay raise onto customers, it would be an extra 49 cents per shopping trip on average. And that's if they passed the entire cost on and didn't dip into the massive amount of profits they're making, didn't dip into the dividends that the six of the richest people in the world are getting on a yearly basis. You know, but they're unwilling to do it. And it really shows where their values lie. That's the decisions that they're making with the enormous profits that they're taking in.
Mike Wilson, how would you characterize the press coverage around Walmart's entrance to DC? Six stores, it's a game changer for this city. And yet you've seen maybe either not so much coverage, or when there is coverage, it's either neutral to in favor of Washington Post editorialized in favor of Walmart's coming.
Right. I mean, it's been disappointing. I think that, you know, Walmart obviously has quite the public relations machine that they've been able to use. But I also think that, unfortunately, a lot of the press here has been unwilling or to really dig into what these projects are going to mean for local communities, has been unwilling to go, you know, sort of do the legwork to talk to folks about what their real concerns are, and instead just buy the sort of Walmart sound bites and talking points about, you know, polls that they've commissioned and done, or you know, just reprinting their promises without really investigating what Walmart's track record has been in other places, whether or not these promises are realistic. You know, I haven't seen the Washington Post or anyone else do any sort of looking into these job promise numbers, look into what competitive wages means for Walmart, look into what Walmart has meant at Capitol Plaza or other places in the region. You know, there's lots of things that have just gone unexamined by a local media that seems just very willing to buy the line that Walmart is selling.
What are your final thoughts as we sit here at Northwest One Library? The talk that was supposed to happen, that you were supposed to be a part of, interesting issues around this critically important issue. JBG and Walmart are supposed to be at the table. They're not here. What is the points you want to raise, both with regards and the ANC? So the government was supposed to be here, and you've only had one community meeting here. What are your final thoughts as we sit here in the lobby, just you, not with the government, not with the people at the table who are making these changes?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we, the Respect DC Coalition, we really want to continue to push for there to be open community meetings about these issues, for there to be the opportunity for there to be a real process for public input into these developments. And, you know, it's just very disappointing, you know, I mean, I guess from Walmart, it's not that surprising. And I think from JBG, it's not that surprising either. I don't think that they're that interested in having community input. They just want to be able to do what they want to do. They want to make their money. But it is surprising from our elected officials. I mean, both from the advisory neighborhood commissioners here, from Tommy Wells, who represents this area on the council, and from our other elected officials, that they wouldn't be pushing harder for Walmart and JBG to listen to the community around here, to at least have some community meetings for folks to put their ideas and concerns out on the table. I mean, I don't think there's been much opportunity for real public input in the other wards either, but there has at least been, you know, more than one public meeting about the proposed sites. The advisory neighborhood commissions have been more willing to talk about it at their public meetings. The council members and the developers and Walmart have all attended, you know, several. I don't think that Walmart or the developers were necessarily listening, and I don't think that the council members were interested in setting up a real process for real community input. But it's just amazing here, the just complete lack of even that minimal effort to show that they were trying. And so, you know, we're going to continue to push them to do a real open public meeting, to reschedule this in a way that makes it accessible to residents and gives a real process for folks to have input into the project.
Thanks, Mike Wilson.
Thanks, Pete.